we've talked about this often, Sue. Everybody looks at you and I and they think we have perfect lives. And they're wrong.
Right.
And they're wrong. I mean, nobody has a perfect life. If people have a perfect life, it's because of the made-up life on Facebook. Everybody's life is full of pain and difficulty. And yes, there may be that occasionally Ozzy and Harriet family, but real life is messy and painful. And for people to believe that someone has something different than that and set that as a goal is what drives the lack of reality. And people feeling like, you know, they've been shortchanged because, you know, then throw the cancer battle in, we can throw a few other things in. But, you know, it just, that's real life. And I just get tired of people believing, they look at you or me and they think, oh, they have a perfect life. She's got a husband who's a doctor, and she's got this business, and you know, she's gorgeous, and
her
life is easy. And, you know, it's just not the truth. And I think women in particular, Sue, perpetuate that notion. I don't know why, but it feels like women believe they have to kind of make up their life as really good, but it's not. And then we all try and strive for that, but no one has it. Stupid.
So, yeah. Do you think it's only women who perpetuate that or feel like they need to?
I think women are worse at it than men, and I think Facebook has accelerated it. You know, other than some, you know, really emotional election bits and pieces on Facebook, most people kind of put up a facade of a perfect life.
Yeah, all the happy stuff, my Facebook
this
life.
This is having dinner. This is us at a soccer tournament. This is, you know, my son won the chess tournament. This is my son is, I mean, it just, and of course, I like the fact that it's happy and positive, but I think it perpetuates a little bit of that belief that people really do have perfect life.
All right, so let's start with, you know, what's the greatest lesson you've learned?
My greatest lesson, it was really easy. Some of these were really hard.
Uh-huh.
This one was really easy, and it was the notion that I can always change myself. And there is a quote that I often use, that the role of a leader is not to manage and change others, it's to manage and change yourself. And I think the belief that when something doesn't go right, that you have the power to change, really, is powerful. I use that. But so many times people get stuck because they think, well, this is who I am, I can't change, or this happened to me and I can't change. I think almost taking responsibility for everything and a belief that I can change, I believe has been my best lesson.
What are some of the toughest situations where you've had to do that? Are there times when you know, even though you believe that, you have to swallow hard because it doesn't seem like it should be your job and then you do it anyway?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Sue. I mean, I think it is. You know, I learned it over and over with the boys when they were growing up and trying to change my reaction or response to them so they would behave differently.
Uh-huh.
Because you get caught in so many stuck patterns. But even in, you know, even in the real world and in business, there would be times when I believed that someone had really done something wrong, you know, had really been at fault.
Uh-huh.
And it was hard to step up and say, even if they're at fault, I'm the one who's going to take the lead on changing my reaction, addressing this, going at it differently because, it's just the way I do things. And it's paid off because people don't expect it. You know, if you think about those interactions and when people expect something like a franchisee has misstepped and they know they've misstepped and they expect us to come down on them in an incredibly negative way or something, and instead you sit down and say, I'm really confused, this concerns me, I know that you probably didn't intend to do this, what can we do to fix it? They feel really differently than their normal expectation that, you know, we would just, you know, be mad at them. I don't know if that's a good example, but...
No, what I'm hearing you say is your willingness to be responsible for everything.
Yes. I think Jerry Garcia had a quote about that. It's always my fault or something. I can't remember.
That's not exactly the same. But I like it.
So...
when you translate it to now, what are you learning now then?
I think I learned so much now. It just is almost overwhelming to think about how stupid I was before. I think there's an openness as you get older. You don't feel like you need to know it all. And so you're more open. You aren't paying attention to your reaction. So I got some pretty brutal feedback here at Greg Cliffs not long ago, probably in the last year and a half, about my multitasking.
Uh-huh.
And about how difficult it was for people, even if they knew it was maybe appropriate. And so forcing myself to really listen, it was incredible how much I learned and heard differently. So that's the one thing I often have to relearn is how to listen. I think really listening is one of the most difficult things to do. Because if you really listen, you learn things that you would never learn as you're sitting there trying to figure out what your response is going to be.
Isn't that the truth?
Openly. And so listening is probably the greatest way to learn. Listening incredibly actively, just really listening. And it has been pretty interesting because people have, you know, as an executive team, we share those things so everybody knows I was working on that.
Uh-huh.
And people saw a difference, and I felt the difference. So I think that accepting feedback, being open to feedback, is a great learning experience as well.
And have you always done, like, the feedback, the 360 feedback with one another, so every year you're doing something, the next iteration of you?
We've been probably for my first 15 to 20 years here, we did it pretty regularly, and for some reason, about 7 or 8 years ago, the one tool we were using the Clark Wilson, and a lot of the tools just didn't fit with what we were doing. We had a PDI-based tool, and, you know, we wanted franchisee feedback. And so we did get a little bit. We did some employee engagement, got some feedback that way. But now we're using the 360 EQI, which really seems to fit really well for us because it really are the things that most leaders need to work on. I mean, we don't want franchisees or even, how would I say this, even employees sometimes, they don't know the technical competence. We want them to really share with us the way that they feel, the way that they're treated, the way that they're valued, and the EQI 360 does that. So we're back on track with that.
Well, that sounds like it's more in line with your core values, too.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about those at all and how they've shaped how you are as a leader as well as Great Clips overall?
You know, our values are different, Sue, than a lot of companies. I mean, they're more active-oriented. Our first value is we are kind. Our second value is we listen and earn trust. Our third value is we keep it simple. Our fourth value is we focus on execution. Our fifth value is we exceed expectations. And our sixth value is we make it fun. And they kind of almost have to happen in chronological or sequential order. I think that if you look at those values, probably the thing that really drives feedback would be that we are kind and we listen and earn trust. I mean, the other things are more measurable, and even we keep it simple because sometimes people feel overwhelmed, and, you know, if you aren't asking for feedback, you don't get that feedback. So I think our values do support getting that feedback and doing it after. We also do, like, Steve and Rob and I get together once a month, Sue, and we share feedback. I mean, you know, if we think someone missed on something, or like Steve and Rob and I meet tomorrow, and Rob did a great job at a close in our meeting in Phoenix a couple weeks ago, and I haven't had a chance to provide that feedback, so I'll do that tomorrow. But I think it can be tied to your values, but there's also the role modeling that goes along with that. If you're asking for feedback, then everybody asks for feedback. One of the stories I share sometimes, Sue, is when a brand new regional director, I was in California. Can you imagine a brand new regional director? The president comes to town. And the first thing the president says before the meeting is, okay, Norm, I have a tendency to get defensive, and you're going to need to help me. I always ask someone to help me in these tough meetings because if I get defensive, you know, I end up not being able to get done what I need to get done. So this is a signal I want you to give me when I start getting defensive. And he kind of looked at me like, are you shitting me? And I said, I'm serious. I really need your help. And that's really, that stayed with him his whole career here because he actually gave me that signal twice, Sue.
Huh?
And he saw my behavior change. And it was kind of a message to him that, okay, this is a president of the company. She's still working on this.
Right. Well, that's what I mean. You are such a humble person. Like, again, that's the whole, this is what I, one of the many things I most love about you is I feel like people my whole life are telling, have been telling me, don't tell people those things. You know, you're looking weak. You're looking, and I'm going, no, I came from a family where they would tell you, not always in a very nice way either, you know, very directly, you know, you're not doing well today and here's what you're doing poorly. And
right.
I grew up learning to go, okay, I need to change that or, you know, think you're a jerk right now and then get over myself and go, all right, you know, they're on my team. And,
right.
And out in the world, it's not like that. It's like we have to pretend, and not say that. So I think it's so heroic and gives so many people so much permission. And that's, you know, just what we were talking about before I started recording is you give so many people permission to just be human and still be really powerful leaders.
Right. Well, I think it's leadership though.
Right. It's true leadership.
Right, right.
Talk about some of those real life crises and or how failure has shaped your life.
I was working for a company called North Central Companies, and it was an insurance consulting company. It was kind of an interesting job, and my boss name was Terry Edding, and I used to always, I would just have a habit of misstepping. I was working with doctors and lawyers and worker comp law and you know, legal situations, and I'd always make mistakes. And I can't remember one time I said to Terry, I screwed up at Getty's. I said, aren't you upset? He said, no. He said, I just love seeing how you're going to get out of it. And the way I got out of it, first of all, is I admitted that I made a mistake. But it really, you know, I think failure helps you develop resilience. I don't think anybody ever learns from success, Sue. I don't.
I agree.
Yep. And so I think success shapes you by teaching you and learning and helping you to be quick on your feet. So I love failure. In fact, I think right now in our organization, Sue, the biggest risk is I told Steve Hockett, our president, I said, Steve, our job is to find our failures because we'll probably hit 50 quarters of same salon sales growth. Our same salon sales profit went from 75 to 80,000 per unit this year. I mean, we almost have too much success. And people have to be uncomfortable to learn. And so we have to find the gaps, and we have to make sure that people know that there are still huge gaps and opportunities and failures in our business. Although all the measures look pretty good, we know that we aren't perfect. So that's our job, to find the mistakes and the failures.
And what do you do once you find them?
We clearly identify them and come up with a goal and measure the change and put plans together and implement. We keep it simple. We focus on execution.
You do just your core values. You just keep going right back there. It's awesome.
Yep.
So when you look ahead, as I'm just listening to you, and, you know, I couldn't agree more. And I think in the unlearning to learn category, it's, you know, like I said, I always say success is a learning disability because you get comfortable, you get routined and patterned, and you don't think anymore, and you don't find opportunities and challenge. And I think you said at one point, and I would like it to be your words when we were talking, something about when you were doing really, really well, you wanted to go back and challenge everyone to think about when things weren't great or when it was, you know, the toughest years, because those were the years you were really getting better.
Yes. I'm doing that with a group next week. You know, I think going back and looking at those times when you're really uncomfortable, or even, you know, even for us right now with our executive team, you know, doing activities that say, okay, let's assume we're down 20%. What are we going to do? Now, that may not be realistic at all, but you get people thinking differently.
Right.
You know, you really do. People have to, unless someone really challenges that routine thinking when you have success, we do things all the time to make people uncomfortable.
Like what?
Well, we dig. We find gaps. And not in a negative way, Sue. You know, we have our key goals and our key metrics.
Uh-huh.
And we have a balanced scorecard, and oftentimes what happens is we focus on all the ones that are strong, and I'll pull out all the ones that are weak. People automatically go over them, so you make people more uncomfortable by identifying those gaps.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of creating energy around fixing those gaps instead of relying on the success. So in the marketing area, if we have four goals that, you know, our online check-in's high, our new return is high, our social digital measures are high, and all of a sudden we have a new return, a new customer gap, I don't care about anything else. I just want to know how you're going to get more new customers in the salon.
Who do you know I should know?
Or what do you know?
Oh, it's a who on this one, but you can do a what. I'm cool with that.
Oh, I picked out what?
That's good. I think it's a better question.
Okay, maybe I have who. Okay. Well, what I put down, Sue, is every interaction matters. And it seemed like it took me a while to fully figure that out. And once again, it may sound like it's more pressure.
Uh-huh.
But once I realized that every time I interacted with someone, it made a difference.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty powerful. It gave me, it's not just like you have to be on your toes every time. It's like when I walk into a salon, the way that I greet a customer, the way I interact with a customer, when I'm in a meeting, the way I, you know, deal with the franchisee in the kitchen when they're getting coffee, you know, the way that I deal with someone in the bathroom, the way that I deal with someone getting on or off the elevator, every one of those matters. And it doesn't make any difference if you're president or CEO. I mean, when I look at my life as a whole, kind of coming to the realization that every time you interact with someone, you have an opportunity to make it a good interaction or a bad interaction. And like I said, not to put unreasonable pressure on people that they can't have a bad day or a bad time with their husband or a bad day with their, but just, it's almost the powerful side of that.
Right.
Like, you just have so much power at every interaction. You just forget about it when you walk down the hallway, when you see someone. You know, people think they have to look for these big opportunities to make an impact. And when you realize that every single interaction matters and you pay attention to that, there's more power in that than anything you could muster up in doing a great presentation or a great speech. Or, I mean, those single interactions, I think are the most powerful. And like I said, I always kind of knew that kind of what comes around goes around and all that, but really just thinking about the power of every interaction that you have.
Yeah, there's no throwaway moments.
Right.
So who and what inspires you and why?
Well, the first thing I put down was 40,000 stylists. You know, I never realized, Sue, how much inspiration I would get from the people in the front lines of our brand and how strong these women are and how hardworking they are. I mean, I just love being in the salons. They inspire me every time I go in the salons and watch them and interact with them. And then, of course, my husband inspires me. My sons inspire me. And, of course, my grandchildren. I mean, it is funny when I talk about every interaction counts and you interact with your grandchildren and you think about wanting to be the best you can be for them.
Uh-huh.
And wanting them to see you at your best. And, you know, that inspires you. I mean, you know, you even my boys, you know, when I think about Sue, when I think about, you know, sometimes they just are, you know, they just tell me how proud they are. And, you know, I don't want to disappoint them. I don't want to disappoint Greg. You know, that's kind of the negative side of inspiration. So that does inspire me to not let them down, not let people down.
Do you feel like you ever have?
Oh, sure.
For any length of time?
No, but I do think that kind of goes back to, you know, you aren't perfect. You will let people down. You
right.
will miss along the way. But there's still a level of inspiration you get out of that expectation.
So, can I ask a more personal question on this one?
Sure.
Given how your parents were, how do you think that shaped not wanting to let others down? Because I'm thinking, you know, on paper, you could say they let you down.
Right. But see, I accepted my father's alcoholism, and I even got some insight into that when I listened to World War II veterans talking about the amount of alcohol consumed during World War II.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of an interesting twist on my father's alcoholism, but I had accepted my father's alcoholism and at the same time accepted his love for us. And my father was fanatical about learning. He was an intellectual. He made us take word power tests. He made us read classics. He had high expectations for us.
Uh-huh.
So he wasn't chronic abusive alcoholic Sue, but he was a bright, loving, driven man. And so even getting those aligned or people accepting that, yes, you can be an abusive alcoholic, but you can also be a loving, driving, caring, bright man. People don't think those can, but they are. I mean, for a lot of people, you know, especially in my father's era where people didn't go to treatment, they just drank themselves to death. I mean,
right.
You know, it wasn't like there were a lot of options. So, and then my mother's reaction to my father and our poverty and the stress was depression. And I think they worked as hard as they could, Sue. They did what they could with what they had.
When I hear that, I'm thinking, wow, if I grew up with an abusive, alcoholic dad and a depressed mom in a psych ward, it's very possible you could have strong times in your life of feeling victimized or poor me. And I'm thinking, how did you reconcile that to find some kind of peace with your dad's alcoholism, where you could see the abusive part and you can see the good part and you can reconcile that? Because I think that's challenging.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I did it, Sue. I think I must have some gifts but the rest of my family, I mean, me and my sister Regina and my sister Becky kind of had a different, my oldest sister Roxanne had such a burden with that. She just really disconnected. Ray really disconnected other than financial support. And then my youngest sister was so angry at my dad, she could never reconcile it. So I think there's some innate the way we look at things.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing, even longer term, as I got older, kind of putting the framework on is you do the best you can with what you have. So my parents did the best they could with what they had. And so for me, doing the best I could with what I have means something different. Because I've been given great opportunity. I've been given, I would say, gifts of intelligence and opportunity. And so for me, doing the best you can with what you have is a higher expectation. You know, I don't know how to, like I said, I keep saying I'm not sure how to explain some of this, but I do believe that if people do the best they can with what they have, it's going to be different for everybody.
Right.
If you do the best you can with what you have, you're incredibly talented. You have skills. You have ability to influence and lead. That comes with it a sense of obligation because you've been given those gifts. So if your benchmark is to do the best you have with what you've been given, my mom and dad did the best they could.
Mm-hmm.
With what they've been given, my mom was clearly clinically depressed. I mean, you know, it was, I mean, she did everything, Sue, to get her out of that. I mean, she did shock treatment. She did everything, and finally antidepressants changed her life. But, you know, she worked hard at trying to get out of that, Sue, but she couldn't. But I knew she worked hard at it.
Right.
So she did the best she could with what she had.
And you didn't have any resentment about any of the stuff growing up, or did you have to work through that?
Well, you know, I've seen counselors along the way.
I did that too, so.
When I was 19, when I was in college, I saw a counselor that was probably one of those turning points when my mom was really bad and things were bad, and when I would go home, she would be really mean to me. And he kind of said, well, why do you keep going home? I mean, you have control over that. That was one of those kind of decisions to, you know, kind of change what you do. Why do I keep going back into that if she's still, you know, mean to me?
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't abusive, but she was pretty mean to me. And, you know, it kind of changed my belief that if I was going to go home, I didn't have to stay there. If I was going to go home, I didn't have to interact with her. If I was going to go home, I could interact with her differently. So, you know, I don't know, but I do, Sue, I do think there's some, I must have been given some innate resilience.
Well, no, I think you have a really incredible worldview because you see it from a really responsible place, because there's no meaning in the fact that your parents, you know, were depressed or alcoholic or abusive, just the meaning you give them. And once you're able to be free of that environment when you're old enough to do that, it is choice, you know?
Yeah.
And they don't live any more strongly than in your own brain. And so it's just so powerful to hear you talk about it, because I've heard countless people tell very different stories than you are. And I think that's just amazing. And I do think it's a lot, your worldview, the way you think about things.
Yeah.
So what inspires you? We got a bunch of the who, but the what, I don't know if we touched on.
You know what I put down?
What?
Time in my own home. I do take care of myself. I do need that downtime. I need to be in my recliner, in my office, watching HGTV. I need to have time with Greg. I mean, I probably get more inspiration after a half hour sitting in my chair than I would if I tried really hard to get inspired. I need to kind of empty my brain. And decompress, and then the inspiration comes.
You're so good about self-care. It's nice to hear that, you know, that you do just stop. Is there such a thing as balance?
No. It's not realistic. It's very seldom. It's usually one way or the other. The scales always tip to one side or the other. It's not realistic. If it happens, it's accidental. It's not intentional.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. The more you try, the more you suffer. I even have one person say that there's balance, Rhoda.
Yeah, good. Good. That makes me feel better, because I think a lot of people still talk about, if I hear work-life balance one more time, I'm going to scream.
Well, yeah. It's all life. What's advice for your 20-year-old self?
Don't take yourself so seriously. Hmm. When I think about the things that I used to get upset about, too, and you know, even in relationships, even with my husband, it's just kind of like, God, you know, you just take everything so seriously. It's not that big of a deal when the dishes aren't done. It's not that big of a deal. I mean, it's just, God, you know, you take yourself so seriously. You make a big deal out of everything. Oh, I'm so glad I'm not 20.
So what qualities do you look for when hiring a new person?
Kindness. Willing to do what it takes, hard work matters, ability to write.
Oh, no kidding.
And manners.
That's the basics. It's all good basics. I love that.
Yep. Nothing. I mean, it's pretty basic stuff. But, you know, you've got to interview differently to get some of that out of someone. But
do you think we've gotten too fancy at times with
stuff?
I mean, because I'm listening to you and I'm going, this is the essence of all great stuff. And I don't think it's more complex than that. It's why I like EOS. It's why it's why I like all the things I do.
Well, it's funny. So one of our messages is keep it simple, and I think sometimes we try and overcomplicate things.
Oh, I love listening to you. How would you describe your leadership style?
Kindness and caring with accountability and discipline. I think people sometimes think that if you care, you don't hold people accountable. That drives me nuts. I think if you care, the best thing you can do is hold someone accountable. If you care, the best thing you can do is provide that honest feedback. If you care, you have to hold people responsible for a level of discipline and thoroughness, especially in a franchise organization. So sometimes I think people think kindness and caring is on one side, and accountability and discipline is on the other side. And I think that they are not at all opposed. They work together so incredibly well.
Couldn't agree more. What's interesting to you right now in our highly charged world?
Well, it's funny because when I was writing this down, I think we've talked about this before. I have these times when I, you know, read about different things, and all of a sudden right now I'm back on the power of the brain, brain health, brain balance, vision therapy. I don't know if you read about Tom Brady and Dubnyk.
Uh-uh.
Both are vision therapy fans, and this whole notion that nowadays, in our world, because of all the screens and all the distractions, our brains have gotten so followed up. And the reason kids can't think is because the way that their eyes connect to their brain has been so distorted. That's where all this brain balance stuff and this vision therapy stuff is. I think it's going to be the biggest field going forward is helping people. You know, we were lucky enough to be born in an era where we can connect our brain to what we write, to what we think. I mean, we have those brain paths are developed. But in young kids or people who just get really distracted, I mean, their brains are just getting mush because they can't manage all the brain traffic.
So right. Wow.
That's my latest thing. Read about Tom Brady and Dubnyk doing vision therapy and how they believe it's impacted their careers. It's pretty fun stuff.
So what's your best go-to source for inspiration?
Well, my husband and a treadmill, or both.
What's your best habit or practice?
Working out every day. And I really believe that people get caught up in thinking they have to work out an hour a day and they have to, you know, and I believe if people would just do something every day, they would develop a better habit and a better ability to stick with it. 20 minutes, I believe, is necessary for stress management. So I go from 20 minutes to 2 hours.
And that makes it work.
Yep.
I love it. So what big changes are coming for you and for your business?
Well, I'm going to change my role next year and step away from the day-to-day operations and get more involved in kind of the political arena with government relations around cosmetology licensing, and that will be a big change for me because I don't particularly like government. I think it's frustrating and hard to deal with, but there are some things regarding cosmetology licensing that are really pretty silly, and it takes 2,300 hours to get your license in Oregon and 1,000 hours in New York, and I don't think hair is that much different. And it, you know, so that stylist ends up in twice as much debt, it takes twice as long, and they can't get reciprocity. So I'm going to be working on government relations state by state on getting licensing rules changed. I'm going to work a lot more with Pakamani and go to South Africa at least once a year. And I think for the business, one of the big changes for us is just we've always been ahead of the curve from a technology digital world, but I think we really need to step it up. I think we've lost our footing a little bit, and we need to get more engaged in kind of our overall strategies relative to technology and the social digital arena. So those are kind of the primary things I wrote down, and that was the last question.
Awesome. So you didn't have the, what would you say to your What do you want for your 10-year older version of yourself? We ask younger, but I want to know about the 10-year older.
You know what, Sue? I want to be as active as I am right now. When I was just in Mexico last week, and vacation is just not for me. And I don't need to work really, really hard, but I really believe that in 10 years, my brain will still be valuable and my knowledge will still be valuable, and I want to be contributing just in a different way and at a different pace.
Do you know in what way or at what pace?
Well, I think it would be more in the nonprofit arena and probably at, you know, a pace that allows me not to be out of the house before 10.
Uh-huh.
And that gives me short, frequent trips instead of long trips.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Bye. Okay.